Yes.
I mean, he was utterly independent, and that is the importance of money, that you are independent. One thing, but he didn't see the point of giving it away for somebody to destroy what he was trying to build up. And of course, people did suck up to me, the Harry Potters and all these people. And I'm sure they came to him for his money. But they also came to him because he was a wonderful person.
Yes, an interesting person to talk to.
I can't think. He was absolutely wonderful.
Yes.
So generous. I mean, for example, I felt when I went away, you know, I've said some horrible things about him, you know, his failings and all that. And I thought again, you see, when my mother died and, my mother's 80th birthday, my 80th birthday, I sent loose leaves to make a book of greetings for her, for all her family all over the world. And it took about 6 months to do, and they could do anything they like, poems or anything, messages, photograph, anything. I knew Daddy would come up trumps. And he wrote a little verse, I mean, worth perhaps nothing, I can't quite remember it, but roughly speaking, you know, about the life Septembers and springs and what one remembers. And then the last thing was, thank you for so many lovely things.
And
she had that on her 80th birthday from a man whom she adored. I don't know if you saw her letter.
Yes, I did.
And had to live with the knowledge that he was with somebody else at the time.
Baby doesn't feature in those volumes at all. I mean, was she just treated by the family as though she didn't exist, really?
She never came to any family functions, any kind. She never came to any of our weddings or anything. And I think it was because we did not like her.
Mm.
Now, I know there's a picture of Mimi de Gilgood there, when we were very fond of my father, and I'm sure they had a whale of a time in Paris in the First World War. But when she met Mother, she was so overwhelmed with her and the family that she would have no more. She treated the whole thing as a unit, you see, and it was a wonderful part. Now, if she had taken Daddy away, we'd have adored her. This little sense.
So it wasn't any sort of moralistic sense. It was simply this taste for the individual person.
I can only tell you that, as I did last time, I didn't care. I don't really think anybody cared whether they went to bed together or not. It was what she took away and destroyed. And it was very hard to be in her presence with me.
Was it?
It was very hard. And this is the point of the violence, which came only once in my life. I think one could, generally speaking, say that if a young person sees somebody winning all the way along the line, they might think, well, let's be like that person who wins. That's it, and I think when he left her when I was 12, she was willing to go on the line, and then the final terrible thing was when Daddy said he wouldn't take me abroad anymore unless she came to him. And I said I couldn't do it because I was living with my mother, and it was all very, very difficult.
Yes.
And I didn't want to be with her, saying all these silly things with her. And she used to be all these sort of pious things and be tolerant and be this and that and the other. And so I used to, I suppose, emulate her because I wanted to win with Daddy. Of course, I never won with Daddy. She always came first. And I mean, the longer this went on, the more I went out of his life altogether. And then I married entirely for the wrong reasons. I told her just so as not to be like him, have a man like him. And you know, I was absolutely ridden by dreams when I was burned to this woman.
So in a sense, I mean, looking at the thing purely as an outsider, she was very shrewd, wasn't she, in trying to
clever as paint.
Break up your, to prevent him talking directly to you.
Yes. Now, it goes one further than that, too.
Mm.
That course she won with Daddy. You see, Daddy was a person who can, I mean, one must generalize. He was a person, nothing succeeded like success. Unless you were the underdog, and then you... Nothing succeeded like success. And you see, when I was married, I knew very, very quickly that I had married the wrong man. I didn't do anything about it that I would normally naturally have done, because I did not want to be a failure. And it was she that made me go on for 7 years, when I shouldn't have gone on for two.
You mean you thought that you would lose his respect if you weren't a success in
absolutely
the marriage sort of thing?
That this was what she would manipulate it into. I don't even know that I thought of it. This was the thing that had grasped me and grabbed me. And instead then of being myself with my husband, I'm quite certain that I'd take the flag down and count him well early on in life. Things might have been all right, but always pretending to be better and kinder and sweeter and gentler. And then I really was. I was a perfectly normal woman,
yes,
who would react in a normal way, but of course I wouldn't because of these. You see, these are the things that I can pretend to look back on now.
Yes, yes.
But they're all ifs. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you, these were the things that arose directly out of this situation.
Yes, I mean, this.
You know, when I was a little tiny baby, I'd come to his study. I was always able to go to his study. We were close. But you see, he was such a magnetic personality that, of course, my brothers were thrilled.
I see, yes.
And you see, my second brother wanted, who was a tremendous comedian, he was wonderful, he wanted to go on the stage, and father said, no, you must get a degree first, you can't have just that, you'll have some fallback on. And he never went to university to take his books there and they never go. And he was with Jack Holman and everything in the time. Well, now, my father, if somebody else's child had done that, my father would have given wonderfully wise counsel. But as it was his son, you go to Rhodesia without a shilling. So Bobby goes to Rhodesia without a shilling. That must have been rather hard for him. And everyone expected him to shoot, and he didn't want to shoot. I used to think at the time, you see, Daddy would never have behaved like another person's child, but his own. He didn't want to bother with us. And when I wanted to leave home, because there happened to be a man coming into my home at the time, it was not very good for me, and I asked Daddy whether we might get home. But those days, no girl of 16 went to the play, not like they do now. He said, no, Mum's not supposed to have a place to be. Well, I mean, you see, he washed his hands. When I went to study composition in Vienna, it wasn't my father who took any trouble. It was my mother who put me in a rather unsuitable place. My second suitable for me, I'd rather have been in among university students, instead of which I went to Queen Victoria's godson. You know? I had the will of a time in spite of it. But, you see, he put out his family drawer, like you would put out your drink drawer, and settle down and say, now, blah, 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 blah. That's why I never could get to him to talk about pacifism and everything for my son.
Yeah.
If he'd been alone, he would have, quite differently.
But, I mean, it's most extraordinary, saying, well, looking at this situation, there could be this, that, and the other to be said for what he was doing. And, if you really try and put yourself in his mind, all this stuff, it could be a ludicrous way of writing to somebody, to a daughter, and least, most of all, to a daughter like you. I mean, it just seemed to me completely wrong.
But still, it meant that I had to go through it my own way.
Yes. Yes. Anyway, that really, I thought I ought to say how extraordinarily generous it was of you to let me see those letters.
Well, now look, you said a complete stranger. You were not a complete stranger.
Mm-hmm. What was he like in discussion with his children? Would he conduct a sort of rational, arguable, rational discussion, or did he always have to be right? I mean, how did he proceed in family discussions?
Well, this is an interesting thing. If I asked him anything about economics, I mean, he'd take a tremendous amount of trouble to explain, what maybe I'm getting now, but say anything, Benny would flare up in no ordinary way. Because he'd wanted home rule for Ireland, he thought the whole thing was wrong. And he was disgusted that my brother should be in any part of it, regardless of the fact that my brother had been in Roman Catholic churches where he had heard the priests inciting people to murder, such as he in his civilian clothes. And he wouldn't listen to this. I mean, all right. Listen and say, well, that's out. I don't agree with that either. Meet us somewhere. Let's meet somewhere. Mm-hmm. No. I could see him holding himself in with his dilating his nostrils and Murray trying to keep the peace the other end, and my poor brother saying, but you haven't been there and you don't know. But Daddy said, ah, but you have no idea the history that's there. And everything. Both were right. And it was very hard for Eric, who had been through this, as was hard for Mummy, whose beautiful brothers had all come from China, from up the Peace River, from Africa, to serve the colours, to have Daddy
appreciating, yes. Mm. But was that unique, that particular incident, or did he tend to flare up about matters of conduct, so to speak, when it wasn't purely an academic argument or an academic discussion, when it actually affected what people did, who were there? I mean, or was this really an isolated incident you can think of, this back and tan argument? Of course, it was a major issue, wasn't it, at the time?
We left, it was just that short time, after coming back to Newland Park after the war.
But he liked arguments of an academic sort, did he?
Yes, very, very much. And he loved explaining things to people. But I'll tell you what I remembered of him. He used to get indignant at me, and, you know, as much as to say, I think I told you that the only really nasty thing he had ever to say to me was third-class mentality. Well, when he felt he'd got somebody third-class mentality, well, he just wouldn't bother with them. And he would cross, well, of course, we think that, well, therefore, can't he stop? It was the same with Mummy, you see. If she tried to say anything, he would utterly stomp on him, and I'd see his face. And I think I told you I was much more afraid of Dad's anger, and I was afraid of Mummy's grief.
Mm. Do you think privately he thought she was a third-class mortality?
I don't say she was a third-class, but she wasn't up to him at all.
No.
She had beauty, she had grace, she had everything that a man would want to breed from, if you like. And he loved her when she loved him when she was 9, and she married him when she was 18, and I did see some of the letters that she had kept after she died, and I know how he adored her, the wonderful love letters he wrote her, which makes it all the more terrible when he had this flavour of bohemianism. And Mummy gave up singing after the war because she said to me, I remember her saying, you can't sing when your heart is broken. Maybe true, maybe not, but still. And then you see, he'd finished with her. And he paid us off. He was generous up to point. Much more than his little brother was.
But you see, Baby was a third-class mentality too. That's the puzzle of the whole thing, isn't it?
She was so clever. Now, this is, you see, what she would do. I watched this very carefully. Third-class, tenth grade. She was clever. She would listen to what Daddy said on Thursday. She would sit on it quietly. And then, on Sunday, she would say something. Daddy had forgotten that he'd said it. And it was original. Isn't she wonderful?
I see, she'd store it up.
She'd store it up and sick it up. I used to call it that when I was a child. I'd tell Mummy she sicks it all up 3 days later and thinks it's wonderful because it's... I remember. See, she wasn't intelligent. She forgot what she told me when I was a child about herself, that she was a little orphan and nobody let her, she didn't belong anywhere and everything. Well, then, of course, she started talking out of this family and she was a calm down.
in a sense, they're
the eldest nephew, who was the inherited everything, Peter Harlan, said to me, not so very well before she died, "Now, is baby sincere or isn't she?" And I said, "Peter, she's completely sincere in her insincerity, because she had been insincere so long. But, so far as that Paris incident..."
The stigmata, you mean?
The stigmata, she did not know. See, that Lewis Gilgood had told. She did not know. I've forgotten the story exactly.
Yes, the driver told.
That's right. And she didn't know that Lewis was in it at all, that he could possibly have told. She thought she was got away with it, but she hadn't.
You mean it definitely was a lie on her part?
Oh, no, definitely. It was a weird action.
He never realised, of course, this.
Never. And Lewis wouldn't tell him. And she never realized, you see, the driver was off and away so that she could get away with this extraordinary, you know, "Daddy, isn't it extraordinary?" But you see, it had been told her. Daddy never knew it had been told her.
Yes.
That was why, because Kitten and Aldous Huxley, I mean, we were all great friends, but Kitten and Aldous Huxley were particularly great friends, and Minnie had them always.
He got it from Kitten.
Yes.
That's it, yeah.
Because then I could understand about how Daddy could bother with me. You know, she was so pure when she was having lunch with the Huxleys and everybody in Italy, and they passed to them. He said, I do not want to get coarse, and passes it to me. And he says, I will have some, because nothing would make me coarse. But I mean, that wasn't very popular, was it? Daddy asked all his friends.
Yes, and Paul Huxley was one of them.
Oh, definitely. But he hadn't time for it. I mean, if Daddy would have met him at his club on his own, he might have found it just as good value as ever. But no, it had to be home, baby, and Jane, perhaps her red hair, which was supposed to be red and had been dyed, but you know, it's
But it's interesting, actually, the travel things, the Japan book, is very like Beyond the Mexique Bay in Aldous Huxley's travel book.
Yes.
And I must say, I thought that they would have got on awfully well together. Yes, before Baby came along. And then Baby sort of stood between them, and she sort of split them up, in a sense, as she split up.
Well, I remember when I was in Paris going with my father to Spain. I went and saw them. They were doing the Amiens Martin. And I was only 15 or something. And I came through to go through the Daddy's bedroom to go out to the bathroom or something. And there was Baby in bed with Daddy. Breakfast. Oh, this is my family tree. Come and join us, and all this sort of thing. And I was very shocked. I was very stuffy little thing. You know, it wasn't sort of a usual thing. And he had a party, and there was Paul Giardi there. The note wine, why do you remember?
No,
you're too young. And Paul Giardi was quite a person, rather like Christopher Fry became here for a while. And Paul Giardi came and sat on the sofa with me. We were getting on splendidly, having a wonderful talk. Ah, could I be left with Paul Giardi? No. Ooh, come away. And I never, ever had another word with Paul Giardi. And she couldn't bear it.
You mean, not only did she want to hang on to him, your father, but she wanted to prevent. She wanted to be the centre of attention.
Exactly. I certainly wouldn't want Paul Giardi to say anything nice about me if she thought he might.
But again, the Sunday treat thing with her in bed with your father confirms your supposition that there wasn't any really sexual relationship between them at all. She was like a sort of little girl who was let into the bed with Daddy.
It's perfectly true, but you see, I believe that she would never have held Daddy had she.
Mm.
And I have absolute indisputable evidence that he didn't get what he... suppose you want from a mistress.
Yes. Well, that also Aldous Huxley says, doesn't he, in the essay? I mean, he says that he has nothing to say like that between them at all.
Oh, you see, she got him from a totally different angle. You see, says, well, so he was so gullible from that point of view.
The story the truth is much more extraordinary than the story, isn't it? Because in the story, Paul's accent makes it more explicable because this man was uneducated and didn't know what was going on.
Well, he had to cover himself.
Yes, I see. Whereas, in fact, what makes it doubly extraordinary, this was an educated, sophisticated man who was seduced by this woman. I mean, so the truth is, really, in this case, definitely stranger than fiction.
Yes, but when Danny had read that, he didn't.
He read it, did he?
Oh, yes, he read anything of Aldous Huxley's.
I see, what happened?
Danny said, if he's gone off, he's gone terribly off. I'm not interested in Aldous Huxley anymore. And, you know, well, he wasn't going to have anybody. He'd been found out.
I see, he recognised himself.
He was a monkey and fairy, but he sort of didn't know about that story. He thought, I mean, he must have remembered about the stigmata thing. But whether he believed it and didn't want to believe it or not, I don't know. But from then on, he never saw the Huxley again.
Interesting.
I never asked him. I don't know what he believed. He didn't want to believe anything about maybe he was totally committed, and that was all.
See, I was going to, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you, whether in fact he knew about this story, and if so, how he took it.
I'm sure, because you always read in the news.
And he liked Huxley, I would imagine.
Oh, but they went on holidays to Italy together. I mean, Daddy used to go backwards and forwards from Italy. First of all, baby was put into a nunnery of the old one. Daddy looked after her. See, she got him. Wrote to him every year for 7 years. What a wonderful man. She'll never forget how he helped her and everything. Well, then, of course, when things went badly with Mummy and Daddy, I mean, it was a funnel ready to fall into a basket. And there was the basket. And Mummy didn't know anything about him. In fact, he'd said, oh, this woman, she writes to me every year and everything. But then, Mummy, when Daddy wanted to leave her, Mummy said, all right, where are you going? Adam Street, off Baker Street. And she did his place up for him, and was heartbroken, but he had to go. And as I said, he went off with a Maples removal man sitting in the chair. He smoked me a cigar and then goodbye.
They also were both at your wedding, I noticed. I mean,
my mother and father.
Yes, they stuck together in a sense, didn't they?
He asked her for logistics to the theatre once a year, and then when she couldn't hear or see very well, she did go to lunch with him once a year, but she'd go to England or something, and it was a chore, I think, for him.
Well, she, of course, was still in love with him.
Oh, of course. Mm-hmm. Loved him, and she'd come back and say it was lovely to hear, but, you know, sad and all that. And we never invited her to our weddings.
And did he resent that? I mean, did he?
I don't know.
He never said anything to you about that?
I think he thought it was all my mother's fault, but I think that, I mean, I don't really know where I stand in this, at this moment. I went through certainly a long phase where these sins were mended in certain ways. Why have awful family rows? It seemed to be a fairly civilized way of going on. He didn't want baby involved in dinner. Divorce, had Mummy wanted a divorce, she could have used baby. He was protecting baby. He wasn't protecting her. Him.
Yes.
And she would say, oh, you know, it's a pure divorce. She always used to say to me, I mean, there was a woman called Bert Rainey, an old friend of the family, who was very French, and baby used to go about talking about being 30 and everything. And this woman said, how old are you? So baby said, oh, I'll be 30 next birthday. She said, well, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. She never talked about being a virgin after that.
Who actually was she? I don't know how much you know. Who was she?
I have no idea who she was. She was, but her name is Mulock, which is not an unknown name in Ireland. And we think that she was an illegitimate child of a certain gentleman who had some land or something. She wanted to show it to Daddy. She was, I know she was a sort of housekeeper in Liverpool. She certainly spoke with a very slight Liverpool accent. And, she was in, what was I going to say? I've lost the thread of what I was going to say. Well, she came through the passport office and said, I'm running away from temptation. Well, you can imagine that would Cecil Scott, who was a great friend of ours, being at dinner with Daddy in Adam Street, and he told me this afterwards. I don't know who else was there, but Amy would suddenly say, Daddy, where do little minks come from? And somebody said, from the same place the babies get minks. In the same place the babies get minks. So you see.
This is flattering.
But you can imagine that this was a pretty traumatic thing to have to live through.
Oh, yes.
Then go home to Mummy and have this awful thing going on in the back. But as I said, when Daddy, I always talked with him, and if I wanted to talk to him very seriously about something, but like the first time I had cancer, I felt older doing that. He did come and take me to the trombone, and I said I'd rather nobody knew about it. And the next thing he did was try and say, I must tell baby. Well, I was threatened with losing a breast. I did not lose a breast, but I was threatened about it. I was very sensitive about it. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to know. And so when I wrote back, I said, well, I think that your need to tell baby is greater than my need. And my need seems to be that nobody should know.
Anyway, she was quite a sort of obscure origins, and she did, obscure socially and in every other way.
Every other way, certainly. I mean, she had nothing, and she had no daddy to send her off to make her better. See, whenever there was ever anything cropped up between them, she would immediately get ill.
As in the story.
She would get ill, and she would lie there with a thing over her head, and then he would send her off on cruise, send her to Italy, and everything. He didn't jump into this living together immediately at all. This was sort of cat and mouse thing for about 3 years, I imagine. And eventually, I think he found that she cooked very well for him and she made him feel good, and by that time...
He was getting on.
Yeah, I suppose.
Mm. Anyway, I mean, really...
When Mummy died for her old housekeeper, you know. I was concerned about her. When somebody served you for years, they said, you can't see them at the mercy of a landlady who can kick you out and tell you you can't have your budget or something. And so one of my sisters and I got together and said, well, we'd find her a little bungalow somewhere. But you know, when we'd already been talking about that, Daddy wrote to me and said, are you satisfied with what your mother's done for Paula? Because if not, what do you think? And I'll help. Well, that was very, you see, that was true, Daddy.
Yes.
That was true, Daddy.
It was all chivalrous, decent.
Decent thing, taking care, even though it was only his wife's. Mm. You see? Mm. It was very, very decent. But you can see when his letters about my husband's behavior was after my husband had married the woman that he'd introduced her to. That's what made him write to me at all. It was because he didn't follow through this. I mean, I'm going to use this woman as a had to use something.
Well, family, I mean, if you read that book about the love letters book, it's full of unorthodox ideas about the family. And I wondered whether these developed later as a rationalisation of what he'd already done, or whether he'd always had them. And the idea that people shouldn't get married, they're in love, and all this.
As far as I know. As far as I can know, I think I tell you, you must remember that you're talking to a little girl of 5 years,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
Before, and we were separated in the war. I saw him very, very little.
Yes.
In the war. 5, 4, yes, a long time.
Yes.
Before then, and they were always doing things together. They were going up the suffrage movement. Mummy tied herself to the railings. I remember seeing her being wound round with corrugated paper because the policemen liked pinching women. I mean, it wasn't because they were going up, they were doing all these things together and everything. Then after the war, he would, then he was messing about, and then came this new thing to me, free love. You know, what is free love? And be surprised if he didn't think it was all right, but it hadn't come to the surface.
No, I see. He did talk about it quite a lot, that he
afterwards,
later on.
Yes, afterwards. I mean, he used to bring the most extraordinary people to the house, and one would sense that he was all entranced by this woman or that woman. And I remember this long dinner table, lunch and table happened to be in Newland Park, and Elsie, sitting with her black hair all over her eyes. And Daddy said, Elsie, then why do you wear your hair all over your face like that? You have such beautiful eyes. Ah, she said, because the eyes are the windows to my soul. And Mummy said, well, your soul must be in an awful mess if you want to act it so much. But Daddy thought this was wonderful. And you know, you could sense him.
So in a sense, there are other babies before the baby. Well, at least there are other rivals, in a sense, before she finally took it.
I remember one we had, my dear, he paid for a hand luggage to be child by another man in Germany. And we all went and assisted, you know, like a little... And he told us at dinner what had happened and how the doctor eventually squeezed her this way or that way. And this was all in front of my mother.
Extraordinary.
He was quite an exceptional person with exceptional ideas, and he was exceptional from the word go. And he didn't break out of the what he thought or felt or whatever. He didn't break out until he had broken out in Paris. Mm-hmm. And then he couldn't stand it anymore. I'm quite sure that as a child, he probably had all these going through mine and had this sort of temptation, but it wasn't, nothing was anywhere near the same, so it's difficult for us now to think
yes,
back
yes.
to when was it, the beginning of this century?
Yes, yes, it would appear.
I mean, he was obviously anti-war, but he wasn't the only anti-British in the World War, he wasn't the only one, that was nothing, but he obviously was that way.
Was he actually, well, you mentioned it, was he in fact patriotic, would you say? I mean, he of course did this hotel hospital business in the First World War, and he clearly came back to England in 1939. Did he have affection for this country, despite living in Paris?
I don't think he had much affection for this country. I don't think so. Mm. I think this thing had to be done. Now, you said yourself how it was taken up with something. Mm. And once Daddy had decided that something ought to be done, you know, there's nothing he wouldn't have done or got involved in or given. Mm. Now, when he came to the Second World War, he was in Paris and he saw how France was divided right down, that the lower, the ranks were all very communistic and the upper echelons were obviously right-wing, and he came back with all these stories. He came back on the last boat to Saint-Simon and all this sort of thing. He was disgusted with the way the British Council behaved down there. Then he came back to England, and then he involved himself with all this business and had a tremendous respect and admiration for the EastEnders that he was working for. He took, I asked him to take me, and to take my daughter, Anne's mother, to step there to see the houses that had gone up, the prefabs and all that, to show her the thing. And Daddy spoke with tremendous admiration for the way these people had. I think then he was would have done anything to help them. They were human beings. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he had anything much to say for the people. Now, I think he was right. I mean, from Asquith to this dreadful man, Snowden.
Yes.
I mean, we were quite friends with the MacDonalds, and I think that when Mrs. MacDonald died, we had the book Girls to Steal Soldiers, didn't they?
Did you? Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't stand any of these wishy-washy people.
Mm-hmm.
If they didn't stick to their guns, he had no time for them at all. Then he went further and further to the left.
Was it a strain, actually, moving further left, in the sense that it cuts him off from people of his own class to some extent in England? Since, I mean, intellectuals and people, intelligent people in England were never completely alienated from the power structures in this country.
Now, this is a very complicated question, I'll tell you why. He had another family row with the family because
Yes.
I told you that.
Yes.
And he was absolutely adamant that he didn't give a damn. He was a socialist. He wasn't going to give that for anybody. Mm-hmm. And then the family, we didn't go to Warren Lodge for holidays, we didn't go here for holidays, and nobody, etc. And eventually, mommy, but I don't think he gave a damn for anybody, really. But towards the end, when baby started giving herself asthma crisis, he sort of went along with her.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, anyway, he's not a gentleman watching, so all that brought to it. She wasn't, wasn't daddy at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I knew father, people were people were people.
Mm-hmm. Except that there is this sort of intellectual snobbery about him, which you mentioned, you know, third rate mentality sort of thing, which is a sort of, which is a form of snobbery, isn't it? But a different form from the social snobbery of baby, isn't it?
Absolutely. I don't think he was even social snob properly. It would be his way out of not being bothered with somebody that he... Now, had somebody been a third rate mentality, if you like, and come to him for help truthfully, etc., he would have done anything. But if he didn't want to and he didn't think they were worth doing, then he would fob it off. I honestly believe that.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone in trouble, whatever they were like, but he wouldn't have buddy knowledge with somebody with whom he didn't think it was worth having.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, there is a certain sort of a sort of delight in life and in the enjoyment of life and the richness of life in him, isn't there? A sort of Epicure quality, which, you know, obviously Job brings out in that interesting little passage in that book. I mean, and it also comes out in that letter about sitting in the sun and enjoying it and saying, isn't this wonderful, and it must end or something. Remember that letter in your scrapbook?
Yes.
I mean, would you say that he was a person who, in a sense, lived life to the full in its dimensions.
Par excellence.
Mm.
Absolutely to the end.
Mm. Sort of saving everything it has to offer.
To the end. Except his family.
Yes, yes.
He saved us up to a point, and then to the end. And that, I think, was the his work. It was a tremendous magnetism. Because of that, and people will remember him to this day. You know, this wonderful dinner party. It's very difficult about dinner parties, it wasn't really. He'd take us out to dinner, and you know, he talked with a rather loud voice, and people would still all around and listen to what he had to say. I remember coming out of a Pinero play at the Haymarket Theatre, which was the second Mrs. Tanqueray, and there Lucy saying, "Well, you see, it was raining, so it would have stuck in the fire." And he didn't want to start in the frame. He was pushing through with still with delay. And he said, "You see, they knew how to construct a play in those days. Of course, it's dated. I mean, if everybody who had a mistress had to feel they had to commit suicide, why, the streets of London would be strewn with corpses." And you can imagine the electrifying effect on people in the foyer coming out of the Haymarket. That is completely unconscious. And he just, he's, as a critic, he was magnificent, except I realized that when he was getting old, when he almost quarreled with me, because I spoke to him about the modern productions of the Wagner and what's the name?
Conquerant.
How the sons had done this, it sort of said to make it an ewige Geschichte, right? A sort of eternal thing. It was a universal thing. It didn't have some trees and rocks and things. And he was furious at how dare they interfere with any of it. How dare they alter a note or a jot or a tittle or a tattle or whatever. And I thought to myself, well, right, fair enough. He's 80-odd. That's how it strikes me, my imagination. Perhaps his imagination had past.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps a creative imagination doesn't go on forever.
Yes. Well, yes, it certainly would have been remarkable if he could have adapted that much.
Must have been a sense been latent there, because everybody always remembers him as being a tremendously vital person. You know, he would stand out from the young of his generation.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't bring you what... I mean, just for instance, a lovely conductor's baton in ivory with silver knob and silver thing around that was given to him by a musical society that he really did bring on and conduct and bring on. And, you know, when he left, they gave him this. I mean, he didn't even study music.
Mm. He just had this all pervasive sort of talent.
Tremendous.
Yes, yes.
We noticed and we did discuss among ourselves that the moment Daddy knew he could do something, he was no longer interested. When he went, stood for Parliament, and he knew he could bring over, you know, the next time round he'd have got it. But well, he didn't want it for that sake. Travis Humphreys, my nephew has the letters, Travis Humphreys.
When you say he was emotional, you mean in the sense of the way he'd speak, his relationships with people, or what?
Well, I tell you, when I was very young, he always used to read to us and everything. He used to read Hiawatha, and you know, he'd read with the tears pouring down his cheeks. I used to remember seeing Daddy, you know, terribly moved by something pouring down his cheeks. That's why I wouldn't let him turn over at my first concert, because I thought he would be so moved he would be weeping down my neck.
Mm.
And I'm a little bit like that, but my God,
And yet, that's combined with this intense intellectual sort of interest, isn't it?
Well, he had a tremendous intellect, of course. He had every...
I think the one thing is whether he sort of finds in Baby the friendship and admiration and all that, which he wasn't getting because of his rather remarkable political views from people he previously associated with. I mean, in a sense, he retreats into her because his views are taking him away from all the people he previously associated with. I don't know if
you notice, Gerard said the county was still called.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And whether the county would have gone on, but we left.
Mm.
And of course, we got an enormous backwash from people. Well, of course, your father, and all that sort of thing. But we were stranded, literally left high and dry, and he. If the people he knew and associated with and everything, maybe we jolly well see that we weren't included. And afterwards you would say, oh, you should have been here the other night. I said, well, why wasn't I?
Mm.
That sort of thing. And I think it was a bit of both, you see. I think, quite frankly, Mummy always used to say, she didn't talk against Daddy much. She said, oh, he's entirely self-centered. I mean, if his letters didn't ask after you, one thing's all I. And you say, well, this is wonderful enjoyment of living. Well, so it is. It was I. And she said he was so vain that if somebody said he was marvellous, he would like it. Well, I suppose everybody likes it. Unless you're suspicious of what they want.
Mm.
But she certainly, Baby gave it all that to him.
Mm.
And she would have him, you know, write about everything. He was always right. And wonderful, she would have a little chair this height, sit beside him in that chair and hold his hand. Ooh. Once off, when I was 16, when she did tell this awful lie about him, and I went to see her when she was ill, and she started in about my mother, criticising her, and I stayed absolutely silent, said nothing. And she saw that she had come up against a brick wall. So then she told Daddy that I'd upset her so much, and the matron had said I was not allowed to go and see her anymore, which was very unjust. And then a child's injustice feels an injustice very, very much. And I would tackle Daddy about that. And he didn't want to. Well, if you didn't
want
running away again. And you see, this is what I... Yes, it is. It's running away.
Mm. What about, you say you used to go to him and he used to recommend reading and books and things. What sort of books did he encourage you to read as a child?
I mean, okay. Oh, I don't know, John Ingalls and Harris Mains, and I've read all of Zola by the time I was 12. And imagine I was torn to pieces by the damn shop and this, that and the other. All torn to pieces, and of course Rabindranath Tagore, and I studied yoga and a lot, and of course by Dickens and H.G. Wells, and I was compared with books under my sheets and everything.
Adult reading, I mean progressive reading.
I suppose it's adult reading. I'm shocked that the children don't read more. Mm. They read such. I don't know, I mustn't talk like a grandmother, I suppose. But he was wonderful, he used to read to us, and poetry, and Longfellow, and all these things. He chose pretty well, because after a while, Martha's quite an imaginative thing for a child to listen to, and then later the balls were the things, and Carlyle.
He liked Carlyle, did he?
I think he liked the French Revolution.
Oh, yes, he liked that's a marvelous book.
Yes, I think he liked the French Revolution. That's the only Carlyle book he ever gave me to read.
Mm.
And he would give us a certain extracts from Hume and various things like that. I say us, it was me.
Mm.
I don't know what he did for the boys.
Mm.
Certainly not my older sister. And I'd get on with it and I'd come up for more.
Did he ask you questions about, or did you have discussions about these books, or was it just a question of yours saying, well, what shall I read next, sort of thing, and his giving you something?
No, I don't think we ever discussed very much, because I used to pop things down, and then we'd have points of reference over the dinner or luncheon table or whatever, where we would, you know, what I was laughing at or referring to or whatever. I would ask him some questions, but I don't know that they were exactly relevant to the books. It was always something which had come up in my own mind.
Mm.
I think I had a very fertile imagination and would refer a lot of things to actual facts in the world around us.
He was actually to look at, I mean, if you look at the photographs in there, a very striking man, actually, wasn't he? Even sort of in his age, I mean, very, very handsome, really, wasn't he? And beautifully turned out. Though, of course, very often these are ceremonial occasions when you've got the photograph, but nonetheless, he did take trouble with his appearance, didn't he?
Oh, well, he was always suitably dressed. I remember when we used to go running around Italy when I was just before I got the scholarship, when was that? 13, 14. And he would take what he called his carefree hat. And that's my carefree hat, you see, all this sort of thing. And then we got Pisa, and he had burnt a hole. No, he hadn't. He put some ink on his grey flannel trousers, and he went to the cleaners, and they said they couldn't get it out. So Daddy said, do you do invisible cleaning? The invisible mending, and they said yes. So he carefully got some scissors and cut a hole, cut the spot out, and set them to be visible. I mean, you know, this sort of thing. And he was dressed very suitably for our going in and out of cathedrals and going in fiac and all this sort of thing. And then when he was going to his club, he was. Yes, he was. But he didn't make a fuss about it. I mean, I was busy in his tailor iron and his tailor horse.
Mm. But he was actually rather tall, was he?
No.
He looks quite tall in the photograph.
No, he was not. He was not quite as tall as Mummy.
Yes,
and the Harmsworths used to say that they thought that was one of the things that had an effect on him. Well, some psychologists or psychiatrists or whatever.
Because baby put that right.
But you see, he always went for little people.
Except your mother.
Well, that, you see, was the first thing.
Mm.
And one of my uncles always said, you know, people marry to breed from.
and then what they do afterwards.
I had an awful lot of facts of life and aspects and things, facts of life stuff done in the very early years.
Mm.
It seemed very strange.
What sort of life did he lead in Cavendish Square? He moved.
Yeah.
I mean, after the Second World War, he lived there. Did he have a sort of terrace?
He lived in a flat.
Yes, I see.
Top floor flat. And entertained quite a lot. I remember his having all his stockbroker friends and Harry Pollitt all mixed up together and everything. And he still had a lot of friends then. And he hadn't quite finished with all this Citizens Advice Bureau business. And I don't know what he did. You see, I was working very hard at the time, and I hardly ever saw him or my mother or anyone, because when you have a family and you're bringing them up and you're working and you're you don't get
home
and see anybody.
But was he living in style there still?
Simply, but in style. Style, I would always say, but simple style. You know, he would... simple style. I mean, he had his club. So what? Other people don't have clubs. He could have a new suit when he wanted to. He had his third rate cigar every day and his first rate cigar on Sunday. And he had baby trotting along after him. Oh, of course, they went to the south of France a lot.
They travelled.
Oh, yes. Whenever they wanted to go, where they went. Until the strikes became so frequent in France and he was getting older and he couldn't take his books, you see, he would be separated from his luggage and they'd never know whether they would be able to get here or there. And he couldn't fly because he wanted his books and so on. And they were always off on somewhere, and then he would take her down to Bath for so as to save her housekeeping. And I mean, in that way, it was in style, if you like. But he was simple.
In day-to-day living in his house,
He was simple. He didn't have a lot of, I mean, no such thing. No, I don't think he ever had a television. He would be warm. He had plenty of help. What he wanted, right? If he wanted help, he had help.
Servants still?
Not servants, a servant. Not servants at all. He didn't, not that sort of style. He wasn't wanting to be.
Well, two servants, baby and the servant.
Well, that's it. Very God, you said that. She was. That's what my mother used to say. I couldn't. She said I might have kept him, but I could not have put up with what baby puts up with. And said, good luck to him. But I couldn't have. I mean, she was much more suffragette-minded than...
Because I want to ask you a bit about her. I mean, you say she wasn't herself active in the women's suffrage
movement. Oh, yes, she... When I said she was wrapped up, I see her being wrapped up under those clothes, warming out, looking like a Dalek, and tying herself to the... telling me afterwards, to the railings, you know, and telling me afterwards that... they were pretty roughly treated, but what she resented was that the policeman had these ladylike women and then could pinch them. It gives an side view of, you know, now I've got you in my power, I'm going to indignify you or something, you know? And of course she backed Daddy up to the hilt. She would get out of childbirth bed and go and help him with his elections, and she was wonderful.
She did it for him, really, as much as anything, did she? I mean,
entirely for him.
Yeah.
She was very keen about the suffrage movement while she was doing it, and she had her own thing as her own secretary. And did. Oh, she was a wonderful organiser. She organised wonderfully. But it was Daddy. None of her family are in the least bit. I mean, that was the thing that Amanda and I struck us so much with her sister's children. Such good people. Absolutely, so dreary little story.
Yes, I mean, I hadn't realised that she was, of course, as active as all that in the movement. I'd forgotten that. But anyway, all that is very much in your very early childhood.
Very early.
Yes.
Mummy's elegance. Gosh, she was elegant. I mean, right to the end, people, you know, she was always so elegant. I loved the thought of her going off and being tied up and risking this and all
office and going to open air meetings.
I think it was lovely. I think it was great.
Did she do anything after she'd separated from your father?
No.
She sort of dropped out, rather.
Absolutely. She was entirely worried about the children, the family, entirely worried about the family. Entirely. She was rather like a sort of, do you remember those Flanders and Swan on their songs with their gadgets, sitting up an electric thing beating itself? She was rather like that. She was always helping people. She was like that in that way, always making herself responsible for this and the other. I'll tell you who was a friend of ours. It was Frost, the American poet.
Oh, yes.
Robert Frost. I remember one of the last times he came over on the entertainment. She was very, very, very family conscious and always helping family. Always helping us with our children, grandchildren, always open house. But she didn't. She wasn't interested at all. She wasn't a reader.
Well, not active in public movements of any kind, really.
Not of any kind at all.
So it really is him, isn't it, that got her really involved?
Oh, yes. She would have followed him to the ends of the earth and not anything. Well, she was involved with him right at the very word go, and her parents didn't want her to marry him, so of course she attached herself to every idea he had.
Yeah.
And all that.
Yes. What about your father? I mean, he wasn't active in the women's movement either, was he, later on? I mean, after the war, he doesn't go further and...
No, he became interested in everything Russian.
Yes.
He read everything from cover to cover. He would have terrific arguments about Pavlov and, who was the man with the wheat? There was a scientist who said that you could have a strain of wheat and it was just...
So, yeah, I suppose he wasn't attracted by Mosley, of course, at all, because he's
supposed to be Oliver was. I remember Oliver, Oliver was very attracted by Mosley to begin with. Anything but afterwards. I mean, he went with that stream of people where Mosley was first.
Yes, the new party people. Yeah. Yes, yes. Was your father, sort of impatient with... sort of the old men in charge of things? I mean, did you have that feeling with him?
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I remember on his study he always had Lansbury there.
Did he?
Always, ever since I could remember. And he had him panting.
Did he really?
I think you see the Keir Hardy Lansbury lot were the people who approached this thing, all right, economics, but primarily from the injustices. Now, this business of socialism or non-socialism is economic. And Daddy then went over to the Russian thing because of the economic thing. And he said, you see, they won't have to go to war. They'll be able to buy us all out. They've got everything in there. They